This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Information for Tommy Castro and the Painkillers at the Aladdin box office and online at aladdin-theater.com. This program has also been made possible in part by Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and evaluate the moral and social condition of its members. Information online at ubc156.org. And now up next is Prison Pipeline.
KBOO Community Radio Night for the 2013 Blazers season will be April 17th, the last home game of the regular season.
Tickets are limited for this unique opportunity where a portion of the proceeds will help support your community radio station.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/Blazers.
Baby, understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
Good evening, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Carlos Chavez. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. On tonight's program, I interview one of Chicago Reporter's journalists, Angela Caputo, on her recent article called Cell Blocks. Angela Caputo is an investigative reporter who graduated from Columbia College in Chicago. She's the recipient of the Salute to Excellence Award by the National Association of Black Journalists and Peter Lisagor Awards for the Best In-Depth and Best Education Reporting. In 2010, she received the Studs Terkel Award for her work with Progress Illinois. But before I jump into that conversation, I want to play a piece by Mumia Abu-Jamal from Prison Radio titled Hugo Chavez Presente.
Hugo Chavez Frias Presente. He came from humble beginnings, from among the teeming millions in Venezuelan poverty, and joined the army as much to make a living as to serve the people. He and a group of mid-level military officers staged an unsuccessful coup in February 1992 against the corrupt regime of President Carlos Andres Perez. In years, the man who led the coup would be elected president, and Hugo Chavez would proclaim Venezuela as home of the revolution of the Latin American liberator, Simón Bolívar, who fought and prevailed against Spanish colonialists for Latin American independence early in the 19th century. For Chavez, Venezuelan independence meant economic independence, to use the vast natural wealth of the nation to better the crippling poverty experienced by millions in the barrios. He did so to the howls of the rich elites and foreign investors. In 2002, rich elites with U.S. support staged a coup against Chavez, but it was short-lived. For within 3 days, Chavez was once again in control, buoyed by the support of the teeming masses of Caracas, who saved his life, his presidency, and his vision. The people saved Chavez, and he worked to save and better their lives. Having escaped death, Comandante Presidente Hugo Chavez gave his life to the socialist cause and devoted the revenues from Venezuela's oil wealth to creating a more egalitarian society. For 13 years, he worked to deepen the Bolivarian Revolution, and he saw a leftist tide sweep Latin America. Hugo Chavez, who survived coups and counter-coups, lost his final battle to cancer. Hugo Chavez was 58. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Next up, I speak with Angela Caputo of the Chicago Reporter. We talk about her recent article on the topic of Chicago's West Side community. Caputo tapped into Cook County Clerk of the Circuit Court's database, paired with a geographic information systems file created by the Chicago Department of Innovation and Technology to research convicted felony cases and prison sentences per census block in the city of Chicago. Her results expose some fascinating facts that may have many of us scratching our heads about the heavy-handed philosophy behind the last few decades of mass incarceration and the war on drugs. You start off your article focused on one city block in the West Chicago neighborhood of Austin. And basically that one city block that you're focused on is basically the incarceration capital of Chicago, and where $5.3 billion of Illinois taxpayer money is going into for the incarceration. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, that's totally accurate. Well, I mean, what's interesting about it is that, so I wanted to look at this on a very, at a microscopic level. So I'm looking at these blocks, which are very, very small. But what's interesting is that, 2% of the city's blocks account for the bulk of the prison sentences. So people who come from just 2% of the blocks in Chicago account for the bulk of people who've been sentenced to prison or a county jail. And so these blocks in themselves are really impressive when you look at the number of people and the length of the sentences and how much that's costing taxpayers. But, once you start zooming out, all you have to do is look and say, oh my gosh, this block plus this block next door plus the one next to that, that makes up a stretch which, is three blocks, but now we're talking about $30 million, and now we're talking about 400 people. So, I mean, there's this cumulative effect that really adds up, and like I wrote in the article, in the Austin community, which is on the far west side of Chicago, and it's really the last neighborhood on the west side before you go into the suburbs. But in this one community, over the decade, we've spent an estimated $644 million incarcerating people. So we're talking about more than $60 million a year on incarceration from one community.
Why is the concentration so high just in this one section of Chicago?
Well, I mean, I think that what we see, the pattern with each of these communities where most of the people who are incarcerated are coming from, they have some common qualities. Unemployment is very high. Educational attainment is very low. Basically, these are just poor communities, and it makes a lot of sense when you look at the crimes that people are being convicted of. Two of every three crimes that are sentences that were handed out in Cook County over the decade were for something nonviolent. They were for stealing or for selling drugs, primarily. And so, there were some property damage and some other crimes in there, but the nonviolent offenses were two of every three prison sentences handed out. And what we see is that these are crimes of economy. People are doing these things to make money. And like some of the guys that I interviewed said, they said, hey, we don't have a 401k out here in this community. We've made mistakes. We're young. We made mistakes. But as we've come out, you know, and got a little older and a little wiser and thought maybe I want to do something different, there just aren't a lot of options. And so what are you going to do when you've got a family at home? You're going to go out and hustle and try to get some money to bring back to your house. So, I mean, it's really like this, you know, the it's perpetuating the fact that there are not a lot of jobs or people in the community. Even in Austin, actually, there are quite a few jobs, but people in Austin don't hold those jobs. And so, especially if they have a felony. But you know, what's interesting about this Austin community is there's a lot of manufacturing and industrial industry in the community, and so there are not only jobs, but there are good jobs in the community, and people are coming in from other suburbs, you know, in other neighborhoods in Chicago, and they have these jobs, and within the Austin community, I think it's less than one out of every 10 jobs in the community belong to somebody who lives there, this federal Labor Department data shows. So, you know, I think the big question is, how can Austin move forward? You know, we have a lot of people in Austin who, you know, at least the guys that I interview, they got into hustling when they were young. They liked it. They liked the money. They liked the women. You know, there were a lot of good benefits, but now they're my age. You know, they're in their late 30s, their mid-30s, and they're like, well, what am I going to do with my life? I don't want to do this anymore. But how do you, and we have a lot of young men like this, who don't have the education that they need for the job that they want. They've got a record, and there are very few, you know, job options, even for jobs that are not something that they particularly want to do and don't even pay well. So I think that, you know, what we're trying to do in this story is really just put a price on it and look at, hey, we're spending this money. What else could we be doing with this money? What could we be doing with this money that would be more effective? What could we be doing with this money that would help grow Austin rather than, you know, robbing Austin of its people who could be there and, you know, helping to make it a more productive place.
Exactly. And I think that this really draws a lot of attention to a couple of different things. As you pointed out, the fiscal end of it, you know, is this the best way for us as a state, as communities, as the country to be focusing our money? You know, should we be putting money into incarcerating these folks, or should we be putting money into the communities so that they can avoid incarceration in the first place? Based on the statistics that you've put together here, it looks like it would be cheaper to do that. But the other end of it is it also shows a failure of, you know, another one of those failures of the war on drugs, you know, mass incarceration of huge populations of people. And you were kind of touching on this a little bit, but you know, what have been, you know, some of the answers that the city of Chicago, the state of Illinois, have come up with to address both of those concerns, both fiscally and then also from more of a, like a community perspective or a you know, a social perspective?
Well, you know, I think that in Chicago we have some little, like, pilot programs and different initiatives that are really successful, but they're really small. And what we haven't done here is really look at, you know, add this all up and look at the big picture. Our governor just proposed a new budget this week, and, you know, we're not cutting money for our state prisons, you know, but we are looking at cutting money for education. So we'll spend $23,000 a year to incarcerate someone, and we'll spend $6,500 a year on their education. We need to start, you know, we haven't really done a good job of connecting the dots here in Illinois. In Chicago, I don't know if you're aware, but we have, you know, we have more murders here in Chicago than any other city in the country. And so a big, you know, our response has been law and order. You know, we're not thinking about why are people committing crimes in these communities? What is happening in communities that, you know, just like the incarceration, it's a handful of communities that account for the bulk of the murders. So, I mean, I think we have a long way to go here, and just, you know, looking at the facts and being real with ourselves about how we're going to start fixing this problem. The war on drugs has been around for 30 years now, we continue to pass harsher laws that are sending people to prison for less serious crimes. So when are we going to start looking at all of the money that we've spent on this and start thinking about like what can we do to make it less, make it so that when you arrest one guy and take him off the corner for selling drugs and put him in the state penitentiary, there aren't 15 other guys who are ready and willing to take his place? Because that's what's happening now. It's like the game Pokemon. Are you familiar with that game?
Oh yeah.
It's like you whack one guy and you get him down and you put him in the penitentiary, but you know there's 10, 15 other guys who are ready to move into his place because they don't have a good education, don't have access to jobs, and it's, you know, it's money. It's easy money that's there. So what can we do to make it so that there are other more attractive options for, you know, people in Chicago, our people? You know, this is our city, and these are our citizens.
Well, and it's an endless cycle. You know, you're not really addressing the root causes of what's happening there, and nor does that seem to be anybody's intention. Like you said, it's you can generate money by doing this. You know, to have these task force, SWAT teams, gang units, you know, that's somebody's livelihood right there. So it's not always in people's interest to get rid of that.
Now, I think I get what you're saying, and I do think that that is, I do think that that happens, and I think that it's not as intentional. I think that there is a real commitment to dealing with crime in Chicago and violence, and I feel like when I'm out interviewing people and doing a story, I'm really cognizant of the fact that I can see the 17-year-old who is up on an adult felony charge for something nonviolent, who is a good student, and just by virtue of where he lives, you know, he faces enormous consequences that other kids who live 3 miles away will never face. And I see how unfair that is. But on the flip side, I also feel like I'm also reporting for the grandmother who's afraid to come out of her house because there's a gang of guys who are selling drugs on her corner. You know, it's like, It's complicated. It's not, yeah. You know, and I think that's our problem, is that we see addressing these issues through a single lens. It's through, you know, a really harsh, punitive criminal justice system, when we can never arrest our way out of the problems that we have here in Chicago, mm-hmm. or create, you know, there's no law strict enough that could, you know, get everybody off the street that would solve these problems. So,
well, and you mentioned that there are, you know, small organizations that in some small way are doing their best to address some of these concerns. As a reporter, you know, as what you've seen on the street, what are some of the better examples of those small efforts that have been, you know, successful in some way?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different initiatives right now. There's one on the west side of Chicago where they're taking, we have a huge glut of foreclosed, abandoned, foreclosed properties that have been abandoned for years now. There was a lot of predatory lending that occurred in Chicago and in communities of color in particular. And so there are, on a very small scale, some guys who are working through nonprofits who are trying to leverage, you know, money to rehab properties and then resell them and or rent them out. I mean, that in itself is like is something that seems to be, you know, working. But the challenging part is that, you know, it's on such a small scale that I recently read about one of these programs. They're rehabbing properties and they're turning them around, but nobody wants to buy them because the neighborhood is too dangerous. So a good thing has been done to get, you know, 10, 15, 20 guys' jobs to rehab properties, but if you're not doing it on a scale where you're really improving the trajectory of people in the community, then the community is, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure. So this is why, you know, I think the big picture, until we look at the big picture, these little programs they're going to be successful and impact one person at a time, and that's powerful and that's important, but it's just not on the scale that we need to really turn around our city.
Well, a larger scale and then also a multifaceted approach is, I think, really what's going to be needed. I mean, the communities themselves need to be enriched in ways that are going to, you know, allow for a better, you know, living situation, better conditions for young people to kind of grow up where they're not so, you know, lured into, you know, the gang structure, basically just safer communities all the way around. And that takes a lot. I'm always curious to find out more about what's being done in different cities in the way of curbing a lot of that and redirecting and, you know, trying to create something good in an area that has so much negative.
Yeah, you know, it will be nice to see more buy-in to that by people who have, you know, the most power in Chicago and in our state. You know, it's unfortunate that we don't see that. And I feel like, you know, part of that is that there's a real disconnect between who is in power and who and people who are struggling in our city. Our mayor was, within the past year, he talked about how Chicago is booming. And it is booming if you live in a certain part of the city, you know, but for the rest of the city, it's, you know, arguably, you know, as bad or worse than it's ever been. So, I mean, I think that it would be helpful in our city if we had more people, and in our state, if we had more people of higher power and influence who were more connected to our most troubled and distressed neighborhoods.
Now, I think that pretty much kind of wraps up, you know, what's going on there and, you know, outlines the story here. Are there any other things that you'd like to add or that you feel would be important for people, for listeners to know about?
Yeah, I mean, if you would like to read the whole article, you can find it. It's called Cell Blocks, and it's at chicagoreporter.com. We have, you know, a lot of criminal justice reporting that's there. I mean, earlier you mentioned that you're really interested in looking at youth and justice issues. I did a story earlier this year about 17-year-olds in the adult felony courts. There were more 17-year-olds arrested on a criminal charge in Chicago than Los Angeles, Houston, and Philadelphia combined. Wow. I mean, our police are very active in Chicago, and I encourage people to read that story and other criminal justice issues that we've covered, because, you know, just the numbers speak for themselves as to why this is important, you know, not only for Chicago, but for the nation.
Well, and this is slightly off topic, but I guess I'm going to throw this at you anyways, just because I'm curious. I saw your article, but I also had looked at a few other articles regarding the Justice Mapping Center out of New York. And you had even mentioned that in your article, them coining the term million-dollar block. But they're coming from an architectural standpoint. And what you're doing in this article is you're focusing on, like, the community, the socioeconomic situation here, and I from their perspective, they're focusing on this as a potentially lucrative opportunity for developers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it would be nice if people saw the communities that I cover, you know, in terms of money a little more, because there's such disinvestment in these neighborhoods that, you know, most people come from. We've had, like I mentioned before, foreclosed properties that have been sitting vacant for like 5 years now, and nothing has happened with them. You know, and the city's only really best solution so far is to knock some of them down, which is just, you know, creating more vacant property and non-productive land. So I don't know if I can really comment on that, because there's something, you know, here in Chicago, these communities are just seen as having, like, so little, financial value, monetary value, that they're just kind of hidden in plain sight.
Well, and there's investment in communities, but there's also, you know, you run the thing that I'm kind of concerned about when developers are looking at these hot spots, you know, these million-dollar blocks, is that they're thinking, oh, this is a, you know, basically, when their idea of investment ends up looking a lot like gentrification, in a lot of areas of the city, in different cities throughout the United States. And that's the thing that makes me a little nervous when I see, you know, Justice Mapping Center putting together some of the statistical data that they are from their standpoint, is that, okay, now this becomes the next target for gentrification. And then what happens to the folks that were there originally?
Yeah, you know, I could see how that could play out in a few communities in Chicago, you know, communities where there are big, you know, federally subsidized rental properties in a gentrified neighborhood, you know, that the data could be used in a way that it would say, hey, this is why we need to get rid of this building in our neighborhood. But I haven't seen that play out here in Chicago at this point.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, that, for me, that pretty much wraps it up. I want to thank you so much for your time today, and I appreciate this article that you put together. I think it's very insightful, and I think the research that you've done here is wonderful.
That was investigative journalist Angela Caputo on her Chicago Reporter article titled Cell Blocks. To read the complete article, you can log on to chicagoreporter.com. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. For more information on this program or to download this or archive programs, log on to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. I've been your host, Carlos Chavez. Thanks for tuning in.
It's March 11th, 2013. The time is 6:59 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio Night for the 2013 Blazers season will be April 17th, the last home game of the regular season. Tickets are limited for this unique opportunity, where a portion of the proceeds will help support your community radio station. More information can be found at kboo.fm/blazers.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Everybody, welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we talk with Rod Starr of Rebel Diaz about the violent eviction that took place in the South Bronx of their community center. Later on, we're going to talk to the folks from EFF about the new copyright law that goes into effect starting today. All that and more coming up.
YouTube, coming straight from a hard knock life on Hard Knock Radio. Do what we do, baby. Yeah, yeah.
This is Michael Eric Dyson. I want to hear the real deal. I listen to Hard Knock Radio with my man, Davey D. You heard?
Want to move? This is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten ass system. Stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Anybody that's come to the RDAC BX knows that our number one motto is you can't just oppose, you gotta propose.
Okay.
You can't just oppose, you gotta propose. So we understand that what is happening today is a result of a quickly and very quickly and violently spreading source of gentrification that is going on in the South Bronx, where real estate developers are foaming at the mouth at the prospect of the millions of dollars that they will make with this land. However, as a hip-hop community, we understand that this is our land. As a hip-hop community, it's the birthplace of hip-hop. We understand that conditions of poverty, conditions of unemployment, conditions of lack of access to healthcare and proper and dignified housing are still issues that we are dealing with here in the South Bronx. And it is an atrocity that a community space that has provided young people to be able to grow as artists, to practice culture, an alternative culture to the corporate mainstream driven nonsense that you hear on the radio. An alternative culture that does not put down the women in our community. An alternative culture that talks about issues like social justice, liberation, self-dignity, and freedom. We also understand that we have served the community because we are the community. We are the people that we serve. And we have to understand that when we go out and do festivals like the South by South Bronx Hip Hop Festival, when we open up and try to start an initiative for a Richie Perez Radical Library, you know what I'm saying, and try to push the idea of reading books and of learning about our histories through